Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, American Islamic scholars gathered in Washington this morning to issue a fatwa forbidding Muslims from committing or assisting in terrorist acts. Many Muslim leaders in the U.S. have already spoken out against terrorist acts, but a fatwa is seen to carry more weight. Today's religious ruling is in response to the recent London bombings and directly contradicts proclamations by extremists such as Osama bin Laden, who've urged Muslims to kill Americans. Joining us on the phone is Roxanne Ubin, an associate professor of political science at Wellesley College. Professor, what does the fatwa say?
Well, one of the crucial lines that's been quoted is the following, that there is no justification in Islam for extremism or terrorism. Targeting civilians' life and property through suicide bombings or any other method of attack is haram or forbidden.
What's the importance, do you think, of the inclusion of the phrase suicide bombings? Does that resonate for you?
It's very significant. It's quite specific. It's not simply an expression of sympathy. It's not simply an expression of dismay. It's quite specific, both about the attacks in Britain and the fact that suicide bombing is haram or forbidden. That's fairly strong.
Well, what does a fatwa represent? Are Muslims obligated to comply with this religious ruling?
No, it's important actually to note that a fatwa is a religious ruling or opinion that's designed to provide a kind of religious guidance, usually in response to a question. It's not a binding law on all Muslims that is somehow enforceable by those who issue it.
Who are the scholars issuing this fatwa? Who do they represent? How are they viewed?
Well, it's actually very important how they're viewed or where they're located. They are located in the United States, and the power of any fatwa really depends upon the moral authority of the organization or those who are issuing it, and in particular, the moral authority they have over a particular constituency or community. So the fact that they're based in the United States is quite important, although many of these scholars are, in fact, transnational and move around.
But we do know that these are 18 Islamic scholars who serve on the Fiqh Council of North America. That's F-I-Q-H. Again, Muslim jurists who interpret Islamic law. Will people follow it?
It's a great question. In fact, this ruling in fatwa comes on the heels of similar rulings, not exactly the same, by other Muslims and scholars and leaders from Egypt to Syria to Saudi Arabia to Turkey.
To Britain,
to Europe and North America. So it comes on the heels of, and in a larger context, of what are often called Muslim moderates attempting to gain greater visibility and to contest jihadi interpretations of Islam on their own terms. In other words, using the Islamic sources, in many cases better than jihadis, because these are scholars who have studied the sources much more extensively.
Mm-hmm. And this also comes in a week when a radio talk show host in Washington, D.C., called Islam a terrorist organization. Who do you think the fatwa really is intended for?
Yeah, it's a very good question about who it's intended for, because it's highly unlikely that they either intend this or that it will, in fact, change the mind of someone like Osama bin Laden or those who find Osama bin Laden's interpretation of the world persuasive. But what it is intended to do in several ways is both raise the visibility of moderate Muslims, challenge a sort of widespread impression of Islam as either somehow synonymous with violence or condoning of it, or the widespread feeling that I've heard expressed many times that somehow if there are Muslim moderates, that they're not doing enough or they're not speaking out strongly enough against jihadi interpretations and practices of Islam.
Because these Muslim leaders, many of them have made statements before, but they're quoted in several publications as saying they feel that every time they go on to a talk forum, the first question they're asked is, why haven't you said anything? And they feel a fatwa will be listened to. But is there the danger that it will simply be seen as an American-backed public relations effort?
I think for those such as Osama bin Laden, who are themselves very good propagandists and spin doctors, I think that will absolutely be his interpretation and those who work in his employ or find his interpretation of Islam persuasive. But it seems to me that, you know, while engaging Osama bin Laden and his interpretation of Islam may be one possible outcome, the more immediate impact or significance of this is adding to the growing chorus of voices of those who are undermining jihadi arguments documents about what Islam really says. And in fact, it can help build communal pressure against the appeal of jihadist views of the world among young American Muslims and perhaps Muslims elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And certainly young American Muslims seem to me one of the key audiences for this fatwa, as well as sort of American popular opinion.
It's interesting. When the word fatwa first came into the American consciousness, and for many of us just several years ago, we thought it meant a mandate to kill. The author Salman Rushdie had a fatwa issued against him. This is a mandate to not kill.
It is a mandate to not kill, and that itself illustrates how rich and complex Islam as a religion is. And in some sense, this fatwa against killing illustrates the kind of argument that's been going on for quite some time, whether Islam is inherently peaceful, whether Islam is inherently violent. And you can see jihadi attempts to sort of take certain verses out of context are hijacking Islam in an overused term and taking it out of context to do things with it was never meant to do.
Roxanne Euban is associate professor of political science at Wellesley College. She's also author of Enemy in the Mirror, Islamic Fundamentalism and the Limits of Modern Rationalism. Professor Euban, thanks for speaking to us about today's fatwa issued by U.S. Muslim leaders.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
In an historical statement that could get the dangerously stalled peace process back on track in Ireland, the Irish Republican Army today renounced all violence in favor of political solutions.
All IRA units have been ordered to dump arms. All volunteers have been instructed to assist the development of purely political and democratic programs through exclusively peaceful means. Volunteers must not engage in any other activities whatsoever.
Here's British Prime Minister Tony Blair responding to the televised announcement.
The statement is of a different order than anything before. It is what we have striven for and worked for throughout the 8 years since the Good Friday Agreement.
According to the statement, the new policy took effect at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time today. WBUR's Michael Goldfarb has been following the story from London. So, Michael, welcome, and start by telling us about the timing of the announcement after more than 30 years of violence, more than 1,800 deaths. Why today?
Well, Robin, this has been building actually for several years. The essence of the Good Friday Agreement, agreed back in 1998, was that that Northern Ireland, a province of the United Kingdom, would have its own government again, and that this time there'd be proper representation for the Catholic minority and Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, if it received a vote, had a democratic mandate. In those years, Sinn Féin grew to be the largest Catholic party in Northern Ireland, but I think it was in 2002, for a variety of reasons, lots of finger-pointing, that assembly, that local government, was suspended. One of the main reasons was that the IRA was conducting surveillance operations on Northern Irish politicians, and the Protestant Unionists didn't want to have anything to do with that. So everything became dangerously becalmed, and the IRA was still out there. And back in December, there was a massive bank robbery in Belfast. Mm-hmm. Close on $50 million was stolen from the Bank of Northern Ireland. The British government, the Irish government, everyone except the IRA said that the IRA did it.
Oops. Michael, are you there?
I'm still here.
Yes. Might be some sound there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to continue this story, Robin. Mm-hmm. And then last March we had the murder of Robert McCartney in a working class Catholic neighborhood. The IRA members were accused of the murder, accused of trying to intimidate his family into not saying anything publicly about it. And Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin, was really put in a position of having to make some serious moves to get back into the political game. He was frozen out, and Gerry Adams is nothing if not a shrewd and ambitious politician. And so the groundwork for today's announcement has been laid over a period of months and highly choreographed. And in fact, we had inklings of it earlier in the week, but there's been so much other terrorist activity, not Irish terrorist activity,
right,
going on in London.
But Michael, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, how much did the London bombings perhaps quicken this, what you say, something that's been building for a while, this sense of that's not the side we want to be on?
I think that it probably hastened it and made it clear that, you know, for Sinn Féin, they needed to stand apart and needed to be able to say, look, there is a time, as Gerry Adams said today in his press conference, that there's a time to resist. And there's a time to put war behind us all.
Well, and as we heard Tony Blair said, this is a statement of a different order that the IRA made. Skeptics might say, why? What is it about this announcement today that's any different from the many failed ceasefire announcements we've heard in the past?
It's clarity and lack of ambiguity. For more than a year, every time the British and Irish governments, and for that matter, unionist politicians have spoken about the stalled political process, they have asked for a clear and unambiguous statement of intent from Irish Republicans. It doesn't get any clearer or more unambiguous than the statement made today. The IRA went on to discuss, you know, full decommissioning, putting all of their weapons beyond use and having that verified by the decommissioning body. So this is what makes it historic. Plus, the announcement was made on videotape. In the past, when the IRA has an announcement to make, they'll send it in writing to Irish newspapers, occasionally an audio tape to an Irish radio station. But today, Sean Walsh, a veteran of the Mays prison, he was there at the time. Bobby Sands starved himself to death. Bobby Sands is the great martyr of the Irish Republican movement, stood in front of a camera and made this announcement very clearly. So it is of an order of magnitude difference.
But obviously not everyone is convinced. The Protestant unionists are saying that the announcement is simply more rhetoric. And as you said, there's the problem of verifying that the IRA is going to dump its significant arsenal of weaponry. But I'm wondering, Michael, you're there in London. What are people saying? Are they too maybe occupied with the current terrorism to take notice? Or is this resonating? What are people saying?
Well, it's been trailed in the press, and I think that there is a healthy dose of skepticism. But I think that on the streets of London, and today I was down in the heart of Muslim London in Brick Lane today earlier, and I think people are actually much more preoccupied with the new strain of terrorism which is affecting our lives here. And it's very interesting, Robin. The police presence on the street, now today is Thursday. The first bombing attack in London was exactly 3 weeks ago today. A week ago on Thursday were the failed second round of bombings. And people are just much, much, much more preoccupied with that than they are with, you know, the events that are happening today over in Ireland.
Yeah, and we just have a few seconds, Michael. Are there any developments you can share in the terrorist bombings?
9 more people were arrested this morning in South London. The police have said none of them are suspects in last week's bombings, but they're all being interrogated for information they might have. And there's a good possibility, we're being told, that the identity of a third bomber from last week will be named later today.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London as the IRA announces it is laying down its arms. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, just ahead, NASA grounds future shuttle missions. We'll speak to a former shuttle astronaut about the problem of floating foam. There's much more coming up here and now. Now, NASA officials say there appears to be no significant damage to the space shuttle Discovery from that foam that fell off within minutes of launch 2 days ago. Falling foam doomed space shuttle Columbia 2 years ago, and yesterday officials temporarily grounded future shuttle launches. NASA manager John Shannon says engineers are now poring over high-resolution photos of Discovery taken as it docked today with the International Space Station.
No one is folding their tents. No one is down in the mouth. We have data, and all I see from the team is extreme determination to go and fix that problem.
Well, joining us now from the studios of NPR station WMFE in Florida, News Director Pat Duggins. Pat, welcome back as always. But take us through the details. What is NASA saying about this foam? How big was it?
Well, it was eerily similar in size to what destroyed Columbia. It's only weighs about a pound, but remember when Columbia's foam hit the shuttle, well, actually, the shuttle hit the foam, if you want to be technical about it. It was going at 500 miles per hour, and during tests after Columbia, it was shown that even this hard, reinforced carbon-carbon, this gray slate-like material on the shuttle, even a piece of foam could punch a hole into it. Right. Now, the area that the foam came off of is, it's called the protuberance air load ramp, or PAL ramp, and basically it's a shield on the outside of the tank that protects propellant lines. So NASA has to figure out what to do with it, and they certainly can't fly the next shuttle until they resolve the problem.
Right. And now we also saw pictures on television of a white piece of something flying off the shuttle and heard speculation that that might have been another piece of ice. Are you aware of that report?
Right now, there were several different pieces of foam and other debris that came off of the tank. The PAL ramp that I alluded to earlier is the one that really has everybody concerned, because that one, at a different altitude, may actually have been, you know, propelled by, you know, heavier air pressure that it could have actually damaged the shuttle. The other ones, small pieces of foam that came off, and also even for a while there was speculation, like all of the RCS jet thrusters on the shuttle have paper covers on them to keep water from getting in before they're used the first time. So the first time those jets are used, the covers pop off, and that possibly might be what everyone saw.
And as you have told us, there are now so many cameras, hundreds, over 100 trained on the shuttle as opposed to the last time, that we're seeing every detail. But what are officials saying about Discovery's return? Is it safe?
Well, at this point, they're coming up with a plan of action for later on this afternoon that they'll talk to us about, and then we'll start reporting on it. But right now, the shuttle is successfully docked to the International Space Station, and the astronauts have the option of doing high-resolution photography, both with the Canadian-built robotic arm, the long spindly periscope called the boom, which the arm can grab and move around and take pictures, or they can just take pictures from inside the International Space Station. The point of it is they've got three areas of interest on the belly of the shuttle, three tiles that may have been chipped, and as you'll recall from all the reporting that went on during Columbia, that's the part of the shuttle that hits the atmosphere during reentry, and it scrapes against the atmosphere, creating like 3,000 degrees of heat as it comes in. So if you're going to lose a tile, that's not one you want to have compromised.
Pat Duggins, news director of NPR member station WMFE, Orlando, Florida. Pat, thanks as always.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
And now for a minute of another view, we turn to former shuttle astronaut Jeffrey Hoffman. He now teaches at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology here in Boston. Professor Hoffman, I know you're hearing from colleagues at NASA today. They're saying that they're not folding up tents, but this has got to be a real blow.
Well, it's certainly a disappointment. I mean, it's a disappointment for everybody who's interested in the continuation of human spaceflight. We've had setbacks before. Mm-hmm. Nobody said spaceflight is easy.
Right.
I have confidence that the problem will be fixed. Luckily, it doesn't seem to have endangered Discovery.
Right.
I mean, obviously, as Pat reported on, there's going to be a lot more analysis over the next few days. But let's hope that what we believe now holds up. But once Discovery gets back, there's clearly a lot of homework to be done before we press on with sending more people into space on the shuttle.
And you've been on the shuttle five times. NASA officials are saying today they don't know if this has happened in other liftoffs. We've never had this many cameras trained. So the question, did you ever see falling foam when you were inside a shuttle?
Well, the windows that you can look at during launch from the shuttle either look forward or look away from the external tank, so there's no way that the crew can see what's actually coming off the tank.
Yeah. Well, and what might the mindset of a Discovery astronaut be right now? I know, you know, you're just speculating, but you have been in that position, in that seat, hearing that there's problems, knowing that there's been tragedy.
You know, the whole business of human spaceflight, as a crew, you have to depend on thousands of people doing their job correctly. Right now, if I were on board, and I'm sure what the crew on board is concentrating on, is they've got lots of things to do.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very busy test mission. If there's a problem that you can't do anything about, better let the people who are working on that problem come to a conclusion. And I think the activity of NASA during the last 2 years to try to resolve this problem, despite the fact that it clearly is not resolved,
well,
but nevertheless, it has built up a level of confidence and trust in the people who are doing the work, and that's what I'm sure the Discovery crew feels.
Well, Professor, in the minute that we have, I don't want to be Chicken Little here, but I did want to ask, a task force investigating the Columbia disaster cited a broken safety culture at NASA, and they warned just last month that the agency didn't meet requirements to eliminate debris shedding. So do you think the shuttle should have taken off?
We did as much as we knew how to do, and there was good indication based on the knowledge that people had of the way the foam works that we weren't going to get any large pieces of foam coming off. So the fact that, yes, we couldn't guarantee that there weren't going to be any of these little popcorn-sized pieces was pointed out by the commission, but you know, clearly the level of understanding is not deep enough. And so, as I say, we've got a lot of homework to do.
Yeah. Jeffrey Hoffman is a professor of aerospace engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and also, as an astronaut, flew on the space shuttle 5 times. Professor Hoffman, thanks so much for lending us your viewpoint.
Always a pleasure.
Take care. And stay with us. There's much more ahead, here and now. Each year in Africa, an estimated 1 million people die from the effects of malaria, and most of the dead are children under the age of 5. It's also thought that, on average, an African has about 1 bout of malaria every year. Dr. Kenneth Arrow is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Stanford University. He's written an article in this week's edition of the New England Journal of Medicine about making a new class of anti-malarial drugs that were developed in Asia available in Africa. Producer Rachel Gottbaum interviewed Dr. Arrow for the journal's online edition. She began by asking him to explain why has the number of children in Africa with malaria increased in the last decade?
The primary reason is that a drug which was very widely used and was very, very inexpensive, has ceased to be efficacious, called chloroquine. It's a modified synthetic quinine. It can be produced in great bulk, very cheaply, and was sold at retail throughout Africa at 10 cents a treatment. As a result, it was very widely used. However, resistance develops. The parasites which give rise to malaria have evolved in such a way that they're no longer poisoned by the chloroquine.
So essentially you're saying in your article that children are treated with this drug, but it's ineffective. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it is by now throughout eastern Africa, it is essentially useless. It's, even in West Africa, it's spread, and there's no question within a very short period of time it will be ineffective everywhere.
In economic terms, what is the burden of malaria in Africa?
There is little doubt that the rates of growth of African countries affected with malaria are distinctly lower, and there is a widespread view that at least part of the terrible retardation in economic growth in Africa is at least partly due to the malaria burden.
What are the barriers to the distribution of artemisinins in Africa?
The artemisinins were developed in response to this crisis in Southeast Asia. The Vietnamese first encountered this problem, appealed to the Chinese for help. The Chinese scientists, they had no idea what to do, so they consulted old manuals of Chinese herbal medicine, and they found reference to a bush, a shrub, which is called Artemisia annua, when boiled and made into a tea, was efficacious. They tried it, and indeed it was true. The scientists then isolated from the Artemisia annua those components that were the efficacious ones and developed this class of drugs called artemisinins. They're not synthetic. You take the plant itself and then go through fermenting and the various processes for extracting the artemisinins. The result is a manufacturing cost of something like $2 to $2.50 a treatment, as opposed to 10 cents a treatment. That simple statement is the barrier to the spread of the use of artemisinins in therapy. $2 a dose is too much for the average African to pay.
What is the solution here?
The solution is the same as it is with other costly drugs. We have to have a subsidy. We're doing this now with AIDS, with the antiretroviral drugs, and we now have subsidized drugs against tuberculosis. It's essentially the same solution has to be arrived at for malaria.
But you talk about the solution is to allow subsidies to enter at a high international level. How would this work?
My view and the view of my colleagues is that the subsidy should take place quite far from the actual delivery in the locality. The way chloroquine has been distributed, and it's very effectively distributed, is through private channels. About 70% of the dosage that's used in Africa is bought by the patient from a nearby store. It's just sold by the manufacturers in Asia through intermediaries and finally delivered to local stores all over Africa. This means even in locations quite remote from big cities, the drug is available and at 10 cents a treatment. We would like to keep this channel because there's not at all clear that alternative channels would develop. Therefore, we want to subsidize as far away from the locality as possible. If you subsidize locally, you're going to have the government distribute it. Public health expenditures in African countries are very, very low. They're extremely low because the countries are extremely poor and have other priorities. And for this reason, we propose an international agency to buy the drugs at the price that will cover the cost of production and give a profit, and then, in turn, give it away or sell it at an extremely low price to any distribution channel that the individual country approves.
Has this approach that you're talking about been used with other drugs?
Something like this is used with the tuberculosis drugs. Although the importance of private distribution channels is somewhat unique to malaria. The reason is time is of the essence. When you got a malarial fever, you don't want to go for testing, you don't want to go for anything else, you want to treat it immediately. So you have to have it available locally.
So where are we with new medicines for malaria, vaccines? What's the future looking like?
The fact is there's no definite alternative at the present time. There are some drugs under development whose value we don't know and are not available. The vaccine is a very problematic thing. It's not a vaccine that works the way smallpox works by developing, you know, in giving you a mild case and developing or doing it in animals. There's nothing similar to that possible. There are sophisticated attempts to develop a malaria vaccine, and that's my personal view, there may never be a vaccine. And the closest thing to a solution is the idea of synthesizing the production of artemisinins. No reason in principle why you can't. It's just that it hasn't happened yet. There are a number of steps that have been taken which are hopeful. And it is possible, although by no means certain, that the synthetic drug will be a lot cheaper than the natural drug. I think it's very possible in 10 years we'll have a synthetic drug, but 10 years is 10 years.
So let's go back to this idea of getting this drug to Africa. Yes. George Bush has pledged almost $2 billion to fight malaria. The Gates Foundation has an initiative. Are they going to have an impact?
The commitment is there, and I'm very happy to see that. It just has to be carried out, and we have to create the institutionalization to carry out. There's no definite plans, as far as I know, have been made as to exactly how this money is to be spent. If it's going to be done on local levels, my feeling is it's going to disrupt an existing distribution system without creating a good alternative.
How would you like it spent, specifically?
I'd like it committed to an international facility. We want to create a centralized international agency to purchase the drugs and to distribute them to the individual countries at prices comparable to what is spent for chloroquine today. Subsidy would cover the difference between the purchase price and the sales price. The proposals we're making are hardly complex. They're relatively simple institutional reforms. But they're, I believe, an utter necessity for the next stage of bringing in the new drugs into play and saving large numbers of lives and large numbers of work days lost throughout Africa, Southeast Asia, and some parts of Latin America.
That's Dr. Kenneth Arrow speaking with producer Rachel Gottbaum for the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Arrow is a professor emeritus of economics at Stanford University. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And still to come, a Here and Now producer searches for a singer from his childhood and finds him living in England and recovering from a stroke. We'll talk to singer Niven Miller about how his own musical training helped him on the road to recovery. You're listening to Here and Now. The traditional way to increase attendance at a major league ballpark is to build a winning team. Sometimes a new stadium can help, but the general manager of the New York Mets has discovered another way to lure fans. Omar Minaya is stocking his team with Latino players. Jonathan Mahler writes about Minaya and his roster in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, but Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, has a preview. He spoke with Mahler, who started by explaining the benefits of the Mets signing former Boston Red Sox pitcher Pedro Martinez before this season got underway.
Well, there was no question that, you know, one of the major benefits for the Mets was that, you know, New York is a rather heavily Latino city, and there's a particularly large Dominican population, and Pedro Martinez is Dominican and is very popular among Dominicans. And so part of Omar Minaya's thinking was that he certainly would generate a little more excitement about the Mets, would bring more fans out to Shea Stadium. He was hoping, and this in fact seems to be turning out to be true, that by signing Pedro Martinez, he would sort of raise the team's profile in the Dominican Republic and maybe inspire some promising young Dominican prospects who might otherwise not have been inclined to sign with the Mets to in fact sign with the Mets.
Omar Minaya is the only Latin American general manager in the major leagues. What are the advantages and the disadvantages that come with that distinction?
You would certainly say that the principal advantage is that he is very comfortable with Latin players. Obviously, he was born and spent the first 8 years of his life in the Dominican Republic, and he speaks Spanish fluently. Both Pedro Martinez and Carlos Beltran, when they signed with the Mets, mentioned the fact that their comfort with Minaya and with the Mets front office was one of the reasons why they chose the Mets. You know, as far as the disadvantages go, I mean, I think from Minaya's perspective, I think, you know, he for years was interviewed for general manager jobs and was not offered any, and I think one could certainly argue that perhaps one of the reasons why was that he was Latino, and I think otherwise it's hard to put your finger on any other downside.
In your article, you point out that the percentage of Latino players in the major leagues and the minor leagues has been increasing for some time.
Yeah.
Recognition of that fact has driven what Omar Minaya calls his, quote, global development plan, which is a marvelously large phrase.
Right.
Are the Mets ahead of the other major league clubs in finding and developing Latino players in general and players from the Dominican Republic in particular?
They're not yet, but that is very much where they want to be. I think that Omar considers that, despite the fact that there are already quite a lot of Latin players in general in the major leagues, I think Omar still believes that has not been fully exploited, that the international market hasn't been fully exploited, and he's putting a lot of energy and resources into raising the team's profile and increasing the team's presence in the Latin American market. Until this year, the Mets were really not considered to be a very kind of Latin-centric team, so he does have sort of a long way to go, though he's well on his way.
The most obvious sign that Mr. Minaya's plan has succeeded is that when Pedro Martinez starts for the Mets draw about 5,000 more fans than they do on the days when he's sitting watching the game.
That's right.
What are the other indications that the Latinization of the Mets has been working?
You certainly notice it walking around Latin neighborhoods in New York. I spent some time up in Washington Heights, a very heavily Dominican neighborhood in the northern tip of Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
And a neighborhood that's, you know, ironically, just across the Harlem River from Yankee Stadium. And, you know, you walk around there and you see people wearing Mets hats and Mets jerseys, and that's certainly one. And you know, another down in the Dominican Republic itself, where you have people who are now sort of tuned into the Mets. I mean, the Mets are one of the main teams down there now. I mean, the Red Sox still are, of course, because of Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz, but the Mets are now a Dominican team.
Most managers don't last long in their jobs, and general managers come and go as well. Is the global development plan institutionalized to the extent that it will remain in place after Omar Minaya has been, I don't know, encouraged to move on?
You know, I'm not really sure. My sense is, and having spent quite a bit of time in the front office there, is that, you know, this is very much his idea. It's always been his thing. He started out as an international scout, and he's always sort of pushed the importance of scouting internationally and adding international players. It in many ways runs counter to some of the other trends in baseball management now. My sense is that probably if Omar goes, so will the plan.
Jonathan Mahler's story entitled Building the Baseball Brand will appear in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Jonathan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Mahler spoke with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. And now, whatever happened to Niven Miller?
Now, let's sing one of Burns' lovely love songs.
Oh, my love. It's like a red, red rose. That's
here and now, producer Stefano Katsonis found himself wondering that recently. When his Scottish grandmother died in the early 60s, Stefano was given a record album to remember her by. On the cover, a singer in a kilt, the title, Presenting Niven Miller.
As fair art thou, my pony. So deep in love am I, and I will love thee still, my dear, till all the seas gone dry.
At one time, Niven Miller was one of the most popular TV and radio hosts in the world. Our search for him took us to Canada, where in the 60s he recorded a television show. Paul Castle is now host of CBC Radio's Information Morning in St. John, New Brunswick. He put out the word to listeners that Here and Now was looking for Niven Miller.
Well, I guess I first have to say that the name Niven Miller was really well known here in St. John in the 60s and 70s. He was always introduced as internationally acclaimed Scottish baritone Niven Miller. So all it took was one appeal, and we were flooded with calls, people remembering the singer they hadn't thought of in years. Here's an example of the kind of call we got.
Hi, this is John Martin. I was listening to Information Morning this morning, and as soon as Paul mentioned about a Scottish baritone, the name Niven Miller came to mind, and I can never hear the song, The Holy City, without visioning Niven Miller walking up and down the studio in his kilt.
Jerusalem, Jerusalem, hark how the angels sing.
Well, eventually we found Miller, now 76 years old and living in Guildford, England. In October of 2003, Niven Miller had a stroke, but he graciously agreed to join us, courtesy of the BBC in London. So welcome, Niven. May I call you Niven?
Yes, indeed. If I may call you Robin.
You may. We understand that your stroke had a profound effect on you, but before we talk more about that and where that's taken you, can you give our listeners a sense of your career? I mean, I understand you sang before the Queen. You once had a radio program that played in 33 countries around the world, a billion listeners.
Yes.
What was your sense of that? I mean, as you walked around, did people know who you were?
Well, whenever I came over, in all the places where Niven Miller sings was on television, I could hardly get moving for people coming up and speaking. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Well, and again, I'm looking at one of the albums which reflects the range of music that you sang, some of the Scottish favorites, you know. There was A Lad Was Born in Kyle, but also opera, The Barber of Seville, Verdi.
I lasso bestemmia tua sarà, la linea tua sarà, sola bestemmia, sola bestemmia.
Well, I started with opera. I always wanted to be a recitalist, and so I thought nobody has ever given a whole night of Scottish songs. And the first one sold out, and another one, and another one. And by the time the third one was there, Decca, the recording company, had signed me up.
Then, as we said, in October 2003, you had a stroke, and to your horror, No speech. Walking was impossible. Your right side was useless. You were alive, as you write in an article, but obviously you couldn't sing.
Well, the first time I tried, it was very disheartening. I could only sing one note, and even then it wasn't much of a note. But I gradually tried with the twang that you talk about in America.
The twang?
Oh, the twang. It's a form of humming.
Can you possibly give us an example of that with the sound? That glottal thing you're doing, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that got your voice back.
Every day it got better and better.
Well, we understand, too, that after you wrote an article about your experience for Singer magazine, which is in Britain, you discovered you had something that you could teach speech therapists who were trying to help you regain your ability to speak. Trills, mesa da voce?
Mesa da voce, yeah.
Staccatissimo?
Yes.
And can you give us an example of those or not? I mean, I don't know if they're difficult to do.
Oh, my goodness. Well, staccatissimo, let me think. Ha, 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 ha. And ha, 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 like that. And trills, I can't get back to. I used to be able to trill quite easily, but trills so far, I can't do them anymore.
Yeah, they're hard.
Not with any pride. I couldn't do it. I had to keep on trying. But I think I'll manage it one day.
Well, I know you are now the honorary president of the Association of English Singers and Speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Niven Miller, first of all, we're so glad we found you. Of course, you've not been lost. I mean, but
well, it's a big thrill to just be on this wavelength once more, because mm-hmm. I had 30 wonderful years touring the world, and so I can't complain about my life. It's been magic, and I can hardly believe I've done what I've done.
Yeah.
But I feel this part is bringing me back to basics, that I've got to get myself right again.
Yeah, it's like starting as a child, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
After a stroke. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, Niven Miller, I don't want to put you in an awkward position, but in case you're interested, for Auld Lang Syne, our producer Stefano Katsonis, who started this search for you, would love to hear his favorite song, but only if you're open to it. It's My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose.
Oh, Auld Lang Syne would be easier.
Do you want to try it sitting, or I hate to have put you
I'll
in a...
I'll try it.
Okay.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot for the days old lang syne? For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup o' kindness yet for the sake old lang syne.
Niven Miller, you've got it.
Cheerio, that's the Scottish way of saying bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Singer Niven Miller spoke to us from London.
Oh, ye'll take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore ye.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.